talking about going to Mars. And in fact, last week they had the big Mars announcement, talking that they confirmed that there was actually flowing water to some degree on that planet. Using the high-rise telescope equipment on board the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, MRO, that's going around Mars for 10 years now, looking down at the surface, taking high imagery pictures. So they've only got 3% of the whole planet, in high degree of imagery. They got 100% of the planet, but that thing is capable of doing a lot more. But looking down, they found these streaks, these dark streaks. They're called a recurring slope linear, RSL. And they're water that apparently it's some form of salt water, like a brine. And it gets the surface wet, damp, and they can see it come and go from year to year, because that spacecraft is up there for all these years. So they know now that they actually, instead of having frozen water, which they've confirmed, now they have liquid water. And all the scientists get all excited because, maybe they'll be able to find some kind of biological life or something within that. With me, I just like the idea that, they can relatively find water easily, because water can be used for so many purposes, and it's also described in that book and other books, how you can take the water, you can separate the water, and you can get oxygen and hydrogen out of it. You can breathe the oxygen. Of course, the hydrogen you can use for fuel. If you think about the space shuttle, the three main engines use hydrogen and oxygen for fuel. Some of the spacecraft, the rockets that we have today, the Delta IV, the RS-68 engines, they use the same kind of fuel.
Long-winded. Holy long-winded.
And what else we got there? Talk about that, and I've got about 9 other topics. So, Dick, maybe you want to stop me. I doubt it, though. Back to you, Dick.
Nope, not at all. For those who are listening, this is the Technical Net. You're listening to Technical Net number 1576. That started, and they run every Sunday night for the last 33 years. And you're also listening to Paul, WS2N, with the Space Report. And this is Space Report number 169 that he delivers every Sunday. So we want to hear about space. And for somebody who thinks they don't want to hear about it, well, you're on 800 channels on your radio. You can tune to another channel. Don't have to listen to this one. This is a planned effort, planned activity that has gone on for the last 33 years. And except for one or two people who are displeased with it, we think it's going to continue to go on. So tell us about any other space effort. Let's see, in that latest issue of, was it Microwave Journal? No, it was in the Photo Optics magazine, I guess. They talk about these 8.5-meter parabolic mirrors that they're grinding at the University of Arizona. Boy, do they have one hell of an optical laboratory where they spend these really great big pieces of glass for the major optical telescopes in the world, on both the Earth and the ones that go into space. Well, what an operation they've got to pull. WS2N, K2LIW, please continue.
Understood. Ones in space are getting bigger, and the ones on Earth keep getting bigger. Some of the ones on Earth are predicted to do better than the Hubble Space Telescope. And all of these different countries that are launching rockets. I mean, just in this month alone, China's launched 5 rockets. European Space Agency with Ariane 5 has launched a couple of rockets. We've launched a couple with the Atlas 5. Just last week, India launched their first ASTO sat, they call it. It's like a mini Hubble, It's got a 300 millimeter mirror on it, but maybe a half a dozen different types of instruments on board, some of them that Hubble doesn't have. You know, it's not going to last 25 years. They'll be happy to get 5 years out of it, but, you know, you've got a collective effort between all these countries, Russia, including us. I do want to mention, we talk a lot about the commercial.
KTUPS has a question also, Dick.
And how many different people are involved. And I know I talk about, we're now at Orbital ATK.
We'll pick him up.
And we talked about SpaceX and, you know, Virgin Galactic. And, you know, we talk about them all the time. There's other ones that are trying to do the same thing, trying to put people into, for instance, suborbital space. Lynx is another one by X-Corp that in March of this coming year, they plan on launching their first test vehicle, and that's going to be suborbital. And the idea of that is a pilot and a passenger will be able to go up for, well, it used to be 70,000 now, and I think it's going to be 90,000 miles. And you'll go for a suborbital ride, take off like a plane from the ground with four rockets behind you, and go up into space, and then come on back down and land like an airplane. So that's coming up. That is two new. Well, there's a couple of them that would like to do it. Very similar to it, but Blue Origin is one of the ones. Now they've taken over a whole complex down in Florida. They plan on doing a similar type of thing, launching maybe four or five people at one time, suborbital to begin with, and eventually orbital. Now, there's a new guy in town. Well, he's actually been around for about 10 years. And they come out of Romania, and now they're renting space in New Mexico. New Mexico has a place called Spaceport America, and SpaceX is renting there, and Virgin Galactic, and now that is another new company. Well, it's just initials ARCA, and they come out of, they're actually headquartered in California right now, but originally from Romania, so plan on launching five people into suborbital space on their HAAS rocket, H-A-A-S, and that doesn't stand for anything. That is one of the first people to come up with the idea of launching, you know, two or three stage rockets back in the 1500s. But I hear these people there. I mean, they have equipment. They're actually moving in and going to start flying special drones that they've built. But they are about ready to start assembling rockets. Probably about 10, 15 years down the road, I think, though. You know, they're pretty new to it as far as I'm concerned. They've got a ways to go, but you've got people that are competing against one another to do this on a manned basis or an unmanned basis. You have the new Electron rocket that is going to be launched by another company. This Rocket Lab, they call them Rocket Lab LAB. And they've already got a contract with another private company called Moon Express. Moon Express is going to put their payload on top of the Electron rocket and send that to the moon. And they plan on doing that by 2017. And the idea of that is to win the Google X Prize. If you could, and I don't know how many millions of dollars you get, but the idea is if you could land unmanned package on the moon and have a rover or just move from one location to another 500 meters away with HD TV transmissions back to Earth. So win this $10 million prize or whatever it is, I forget how much. And this company, Moon Express, plans on doing it. They're going to team up with this other rocket company. So there's a lot to come. fact that they're not even sending a rover, by the way. They plan on landing this vehicle that they've already built on the moon, taking all their pictures, and then having it take off again instead of a rover. Fly it, you know, 500 meters away, and then do the same thing. Collect their money. It's a lot of things going on. We have another Progress spacecraft that is went up there. It took 6 hours to get to this dock. List goes on and on. Hundreds of flights. We'll try to keep up with them all. Let me drop it.
Yeah, take a little bit of a break, Paul. Turns out that Rich K2UPS has got a question on what we've given him so far. K2UPS, tell us where you're located. Mobile, Rich, and go right ahead with your question. K2UPS, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, did K2UPS mobile. I'm on a Pennsylvania Turnpike right now near Bedford, PA. Very heavy fog here. The question I had for Paul is about the water that they've discovered on Mars. How do they know it's water and not, say, liquid ammonia or something else? What did they use to determine that it's water or brine solution?
I watched the interview. They had different instruments that have looked at it over the years outside of the pictures. And the chemical composition they can tell from space. They have the something called a CRISM, C-R-I-M. That's in the, instead of the word prism, it's CRISM. And that piece of equipment, if you look that up on the internet, it's from space. It can tell, you know, exactly what kind of compounds or what they're looking at. And it's a lot of deductions, but, you know, if they duplicated everything that they did at Mars in a laboratory with the exact same kind of equipment, the same graphs would appear, and they show the graphs. These scientists have been working on it like forever, have come to this conclusion that it's, you know, without a doubt, absolutely water. In fact, they know it's a brine solution by the chemical makeup. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think you you can look at the spectrum of reflection from either something you're bombarding it with or sunlight, but by various means you you look at the spectral signature and you know that you're looking at hydrogen, oxygen, and salt. So I think it's fairly assured, although you and I know that nothing's an absolute guarantee.
Yeah.
I guess there's a slim possibility you're looking at a liquid ammonia, but I kind of doubt it. And K2UPS, K2LAW, go ahead, Rich.
And they go by the temperature as well. They know from the temperature the brine, is, you know, brine water will could exist at the temperatures at that time of year when the stuff shows up. You know, these lines that are about the length of a football field, that magnitude.
Well, so roughly 1,000 meters long, and yes, the melting temperature of brine is very different than ammonia, so that's another clue. K2UPS, K2LAW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, thanks. That was the question. I thought it would probably have something to do with the spectral, like reflections and stuff, but it is interesting. I mean, I know the pressure's a lot less there in the atmosphere, but the temperature's being a lot colder. In my mind, it could have been some other gas that was liquefied, but that answers the question, so thank you very much.
Yeah, while we've got you, Rich, if you could afford it, if somebody would pay it free of charge, would you volunteer to go to Mars? I mean, and all the high school kids really think Mars is the next exciting place to go to. They're all looking forward to either going there or watching astronauts go there. I think I know the answer, but I'm going to check with you anyhow. If you had the opportunity and the price with that was right, would you go, Rich? K2UPS, K2LAW?
No, I would not. Too many more things that I still want to see here on Earth before I leave to go check something else then. So I'd be happy to, you know, and encourage other people to do it, but I don't want to be on that ship.
Yeah, when you read some of the books that give you inside information, like Mary Roach has a book called Packing from Mars. You realize what really goes on behind the scenes. What is it like to be an astronaut inside of a spacesuit? Now, we look at those pictures of a spacewalk and it looks glamorous. What's really going on is nowhere near as glamorous. What the astronauts go through, quite a bit of it is uncomfortable, barfing, lightheadedness, blood rushing to the head, your face getting puffy, your bones losing calcium, your muscles losing mass. All kinds of nasty things happen that we don't emphasize. So being in weightlessness, being in space, particularly being in a place with almost no air, boy, and you don't have anywhere near as much sunlight, you don't have as much water, you don't have real nutrients in the soil, you can't easily set up a garden to grow things. You got this briny liquid solution. You think you're going to disassociate that and get oxygen and hydrogen and make fuel and breathable air. Oh boy, there's a lot of steps in here. So, I don't think so. I'm back to you, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW, in the TechNet.
Pointer and Tabor, I forget his last name.
Tavern first. They're married. He was going to send them, but they kind of don't want to do it. So, but he's actually got a company that's trying to raise money to go to Mars, not land there, go and come back. I guess they'll pay SpaceX or something to do it back either.
What was the approximate number of dollars that Mr. Tito spent to get to the space station? Question number one. And question number two, roughly how many paying customers have gone to the International Space Station to date? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
I think they're up to 8. Cheaper when he did it. It was only like $25 million. They keep raising the price. And now, to do it, the last guy that did it, I think, was around $50 million. Russia's charged NASA to do it. We got to pay more money. It's like $70 million to do it. And so the numbers keep going up. So it's roughly 8 people. One guy, Garriott, well, you remember Owen Garriott. Talked to him on a space shuttle. He has a son. He also became he's officially an astronaut, but a paying astronaut. And if you go over that 100-kilometer area, you become an astronaut. Well, he did it twice. He paid for this twice, probably around $30 million each or so. And he went up to the space station 2 times. He loved it back in there.
I think you said Mr. Tito was there for 2 weeks. Do they all go for roughly 2 weeks, or another question is, what's the longest time that a paying customer has spent on the space station? Over to you, Paul.
Mark Shuttleworth got 10 days out of it. He was the second one to go up. He come out of South Africa. Another software guy. But Tito, I think, was 8 days, and so I think the record is 10. And that's all you get. So, it's interesting to have this kind of thing going on. NASA decided not to do it. At one time, they were actually going to take people on board back in the 80s. And John Denver, he was going to do it. And then NASA said, no, we're not going to do this. So he inquired, and he found out it was going to cost $25 million for the Russians. And I guess he told them where to stick it back to there.
Of the 8 people that have spent something like 8 days or a little more on the International Space Station, when they come back down, do they go on talk shows? Do they write books? Are they all ecstatically happy that they've done it? What's the general consensus, Paul? Do most of them say this is the most exciting thing they've ever done in their life? And as I said, do some of them write books and go on talk shows? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
It was only one woman that did it from India. So, Indian descent, you know, I think she lived in the States. I've really never seen any interviews except with Dennis Tito. And like I said, he's got his own space company now, pushing to go to Mars. And Owen Garriott's son. No, he had to get some kind of operation. He had some kind of a problem with his liver or something. So he got some big operation to do that. He worked out, and he's got some software company. These electronic games. He's developed a lot of these gaming boards, PlayStation type of things, software for it. That's how he got rich. Owen Garriott and his son are actually father and son astronauts. Right. No, I don't see any interviews. Back to you.
So the fact that they don't write a book and very few of them give an interview, I guess suggests that the American public treats it as an oh-ho-hum situation. Or once they've done it, it was quite as exciting as they thought it was going to be. A little bit amazed that we haven't heard more publicity about this. And do the Russians actively advertise the fact that you put up the right amount of money? We'll put you on Soyuz and we'll take you up to the space station. Are the Russians actively seeking it? I have the impression that NASA and the American astronauts are not very much in favor of it. I think that from their point of view, they're too busy doing the real work and there's too much liability risk. Whereas I guess the Russians are too willing to take your money if you're willing to pay. So I haven't seen any advertisements. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Now, this is Challenger blew up. That was it. I mean, you know, you had Krista McAuliffe go up, and she was a citizen. I mean, she trained. She wasn't really an astronaut, and to lose her was devastating. I think they had plans on eventually having paid people go up. But we had got one guy from Saudi Arabia went up, some prince or something, went up back in the early 80s. You know, people were going. We had Nelson from Florida. He was congressman at the time. Now he's senator of Florida. He went up. We had Gone from Utah. He went up. I mean, there were individuals like that doing that. But that all came to a grinding halt at the Challenger. The Russians are doing it because they have, you know, they make money on it. And Sarah Brightman would have been good. She's a singer, soprano singer. She was ready to go, trained for 6 months in Star City. And she was actually going to go up there and sing up there. And that would have been a big advertisement. You know, that would have all made the news. You know, she's done all these big-time shows, super-duper soprano singer. That would have been a great advertisement. I think she was married to Lloyd Webber one time. Plenty of money. And I think she's chickened out, you know. You know, after realizing what she had to do down there, I think she said she, you know, rather be with the family or something. My guess is she's waiting for Elon Musk to get his Dragon spaceship going up there. They'll wait for the other space station that's going to be built by Bigelow. She'll take a nice, comfortable ride up in a Falcon 9 Crew Dragon spacecraft. Back to you.
From what you just said, Paul, it sounds like Sarah Brightman, while going through the training exercise in Russia, somehow came to the conclusion that, hey, there's a lot more to this than first meets the eye. I'm going to be putting my body through a lot more stress, and there's a lot more danger. You think that's, as she was going through the training, is that when she came to the realization and chickened out? And had she already paid her money? Or do you pay as you go? You pay for the training, and then you pay for the trip? What's your guess as to how that worked out, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
They said the deal with the money is private. You know, the public won't find out about that. And that goes with any of these people, unless I guess they tell the public. And this is arranged by some outfit in Virginia. Safe Ventures by Peter Diamond. He's the guy that runs that. And he gets these people to do this. He makes the arrangements with the Russians. So I guess that's all. Kept quiet. We'll see. You know, eventually you're going to have another space station up there built by Bigelow. All these inflatable modules. And then you'll have spacecraft going up to dock with that, including Boeing. You know, Boeing has their new Starliner. I don't know, stick around for another 10 years. I think this will all come about. Back to you, Dick.
So Bigelow is going to put up a space station. Has he anticipated roughly what year he will do that? And the Chinese have a space station up there, and we hear so little about it in the American press. How long has it been there? How many Chinese cosmonauts have gone there? You keep track of that, but I think you're one of the very few people that do, Paul. You know, the American press would lead you to believe there's only one nation that's got an international space station. the Europeans plus the Americans, that space station, you would lead them to believe it's the only one. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
The Chinese one they're not using, but they have plans on sending a bigger one up there. I think the next launch is 2017. I think they want to put two or three modules together. And they've had two crews have gone up there, including a woman. And they stayed on board, but, you know, there's only one docking port, and they don't have a supply ship to bring them new stuff. So they came back down, and another one went up. So, but they have long-term plans on building a bigger... Pangong is what the name of the space station is. We'll see. But Bigelow is... Well, he thought it would have been done by now, but... He needs a ride, and SpaceX is going to be his ride. He's got quite a weight. The only good news for him is he's got two test spacecraft in orbit now called Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and they're still operating, and they're inflatable spheres that have been put up there. They've been up there since 2007, and now... next spring. It was supposed to go up this fall, but because of the explosion with the Falcon 9 rocket with SpaceX, that put all their schedules behind. But he was supposed to launch their first test human-rated inflatable sphere to the International Space Station. So that'll probably come early next year, maybe January, February. They'll dock that to the space station and inflate it, and you'll be able to go in and out of it. But, you know, they plan on leaving it attached for about 2 years and make sure it doesn't leak or, you know, see how it does. So he's actually going to be starting with this test procedure coming up within a few months. And after that, he's got big plans of putting up, I mean, he's got these things built already. It's called the BA-300, and the 300 stands for 300 cubic meters of space. That's the BA-300. He plans on putting two of them together and launched by a Falcon 9 or maybe even a Falcon 9 Heavy. And that's his long-term goal. We'll see. You know, it depends on the manifest for SpaceX. They've got like 50 or 60 flights on their manifest. So where he's going to fit in, I don't know. Back to you, Dick.
The inflatable module for the International Space Station. The advantage of inflatable, I presume, is that it's a lot lighter, maybe collapsible, easier to transport. That's the good news. But if it suddenly develops a rip, and it sort of explodes, and if the door between it and the rest of the International Space Station is open, within a couple of seconds, all of the air in the space station is gone. I'd be tempted to leave the door between the rest of the space station and the inflatable module closed 95% of the time until I'm, by some means, double darn sure it can't possibly develop a very large leak. Maybe I'm just being a grandmother, but you can see what I'm worrying about here, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
That's exactly the plan. Go into it now and then, open the door, go inside. You know, and when the door's closed, of course, they know, you know, what the pressures are and the temperature and humidity. They know what's behind that door. Every time they open it to go in and hang out, they know it'll be fine. So, exactly right. They're not going to leave that open, from what I understand. So, it's not that big. You've seen the size of Harmony. It's roughly about the half the size of that. Maybe the size of a small room, like, you know, 10 by 10 room. That's about it. So, but it's a good test for them. He's got the two unmanned ones. They've been flying around with no problems. Still operating, transmitting pictures of the Earth from space. Originally launched by a Proton Russian rocket, both of them. They're doing good. And the Kevlar and some other kind of material. Because what it'd be, I forget what it is. It's supposed to be even stronger than Kevlar. And they say the walls on this is like concrete, you know, to try to dig through it. Not expecting any leaks back either.
Yeah, you're giving me information on my next set of questions. What's that wall made out of? If a sharp object drifts through the weightlessness of space and rams into the wall, does it create a hole? And there's another problem, Paul. You know what an aneurysm is. I mean, one of the most dangerous things that can be very fatal very fast is an abdominal aortic aneurysm. If a portion of that large artery going down the middle of your body, the abdominal aorta, if it develops a slightly larger section by the Laplace equation, as it increases in diameter, very rapidly the surface tension increases and it becomes a runaway condition. So that's an artery that's, you know, a half inch or 3/8 of an inch in diameter in the human body. If it goes a little bit bigger in diameter, it starts stretching the skin and can explode, and you bleed out very fast. When you take something as large as this module at 14.7 pounds per square inch by that Laplace equation, the surface tension on this thing is huge. And so the burst capability is something to really worry about, as I see it. Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
It's kind of thin skin. I mean, it's, I think, like, you know, 6 or 8 inches thick. The wall is all these different layers of who knows what. But I know Kevlar's involved, and I wish I could think of the other one. Because with a V, Victor, instead of V. But it's supposed to be even stronger than Kevlar, and all these other different layers. And they say when it's inflated, like concrete, you know, you have a job, you can't dig through the walls. Meteorites, when they hit, if you hit, if you have a meteorite hit a metal, let's say like this Destiny on the International Space Station, if it penetrated that, they say it would only go halfway through on this thing, maybe instead of, all 8 inches, maybe about 4 inches into it. They think this is more durable than what they have up there.
Yeah, I pictured a very thin wall, 8 inches thick. My next question is the metallic walls of all the other modules. How thick is the skin of those walls, Paul? Go ahead.
Running out of time. I know the Russians are thicker because they run a lot of their lines and equipment right through the walls. But our walls are—you got duct work and all kinds of power cables and everything. Run everything on the outside of the International Space Station. That's the safe room. And you look at old pictures of the Mir. You know, they ran everything through the middle of it. Out thick of the wall, you've got a lot of aluminum on the inside, a lot of aluminum on the outside, a lot of insulating material in between. I don't know, I've looked at it before. I'm going to say probably about six inches as well, maybe a little bit thicker.
Okay, that makes me feel a little bit more comfortable. Chinese space station. Sounds like it was only occupied for a short period of time. When they finished occupying it and they left it, is there somebody boosting it? Is it slowly coming down, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
I would imagine a couple of years will deorbit. Not in that gone. Fourth and all of it. If you have two docking ports, then you can send up a progress-like spacecraft to plans. I think I sent you a picture. I think they have a total of 5 eventually that they plan on putting together. That's a ways down the road, you know, 2024 or something like that. I think it's a prediction, 2024, when our space station is supposed to be coming to an end. Although that won't happen. They'll extend that as well. Back to you, Dirk.
Okay, I thank you, Paul. You guys have listened to Space Report, Space Report number 169, TechNet number 1576. Be kind to each other. W3 you all. We'll be back next week. And John, you can make some closing comments. KC2WGB, K2RW. See you next week, John. Well, you and I will talk before now and then. You got it, John.
73, guys. WS2 clear.
73, Paul. Nick. Nick, if you get a chance, I'm starting to mount some new pictures on the QRZ site, so we'll talk about it. All right. I want to thank everybody for joining us, as usual. If everything goes well, we'll be back Sunday, and we'll get some of this very interesting stuff. Everybody, be kind and enjoy that time. KC2WGP clear.
I'm going to make a guess that your new vector network analyzer is on that website. Is that true, John?
And not yet, Dick. That's going to be probably by the middle of the week. I've had to rearrange and restack equipment, make room. So that's what I'm doing, and I just took some photographs of equipment that weren't on there before.
John, are you down to your last 50 pieces of test equipment that's actively being used, your two laboratories? Go ahead.
Well, in this lab, I have, I think, 60 bench. Yeah, it's crowded.
Wow. 60 in one lab, and what, 35 or 40 in the other lab, John?
Well, the other is the warehouse and Connex box. There's 400-something total. I don't count them anymore. Yeah, it's crazy.
Wow. The number of laboratories on the East Coast that have more test equipment than you, commercial laboratories, is small, John. You're in the rare atmosphere. Bye-bye for now. Keep collecting. You know, the guy who collects the most number, he wins the game.
Dick, I have 80 individual outlets in my... Just the bench alone has 80 outlets, and I'm running out of plugs to put the stuff in.
Have you ever calculated what would happen if you turned everything on at once? Roughly how many kilowatts would you consume? And will the 200-amp service in your house handle that?
If I didn't turn on the HVA system, yeah, possibly, but I would never do that. That would be some spike.
Wow, what a problem. Bye-bye for now. Enjoy.
Yes, and have fun. Right, KC2WGB shall be clear.
H-O-Y-Y. And who has more testicle, you or Andy CDL?
Oh, it turns out that John is way ahead of all these guys, Joe.
Then most of it all calibrated and running, if not all.
Joe, you and I wouldn't want to pay his calibration bill to keep all of those pieces of equipment current.
All current, huh? That's remarkable. Very remarkable.
You better believe it.
Yeah, but I'm slowing down with that. There's no reason for some, especially some of the new equipment. Doesn't really need it, so, yeah, I am backing down a little bit.
But if I had your money, John, I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay. Very good. KC2WGB.
Yeah, as I was saying, if I had your money, I wouldn't worry about those details. That's a joke. Bye-bye, you all.
Dick, can you still hear me?
Roger, Dodger, I can still hear you, John. Roger, Dodger.
News Line report number 1979 with a release date of Friday, October 2nd, 2015 to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2. Following is a QST. Amateur radio mourns the loss of Wes Shum, WDYZ, a pioneer in single sideband.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note the 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
That was when we were on schedule. We got pushed back by one day, And with the extra added moisture and everything else, we're going to probably keep things off it till, I'm assuming, Thursday, Friday the latest. So this way he'll be able to get his colorizing agents and stuff on, because he hasn't been able to do much except the edge of the stoop with all of the crazy weather that we had. So now that it's had a chance to dry up some of the moisture to come out of it, it's going to be able to be get all the acid washing and all the other nonsense done to it.
Oh, the color isn't part of the mix? I thought it would be that way. He adds the color on afterwards?
Yes, for certain things. For certain things he was able to pour the concrete, like the perimeter blockings and stuff like that. That was able to be done in dark gray. But it'll get the effects and all the other stuff that we wanted in the other parts. That has to be applied after.
So, if you're applying it afterwards, if it's going to be a high traffic area, does it have the possibility of wearing off, like if it was pink?
Not at all. Not at all. This stuff is going to be permanent, and it won't be worn off. And in 1 month, the concrete gets sealed, and it gets a special sealer put down on it.
This is quite a process, not like a normal concrete job.
Even regular concrete should be sealed after 30 days or 60 days, but this is a very normal process for concrete.
I've never heard of anyone coming around and sealing concrete.
Okay. That's because the kind of concrete that you deal with, people don't generally seal it.
Okay. This is very high compression concrete, and I guess it's more critical.
More or less.
The only concrete work I've ever had done was sidewalk kind of stuff.
And you'll almost never seal that, because sidewalk flags are sidewalk flags are sidewalk flags.
I will say that when I expanded my driveway many, many years ago, they never came back and sealants on that.
Okay.
But I will say the concrete they used has got to be different than the concrete on the rest of the driveway, because even though it's got a lot of, wear on it from driving and in the weather and all that, because it's been there quite a long time, still a much smoother mix than the original drive portion of the driveway.
Oh, it's all materials.
You know, the usual mix is Portland cement, sand, and gravel. And I'm trying to figure out which would be, quote, a stronger concrete. How do you vary it? Which element makes it stronger?
There are all different ratios for all different purposes. Generally, the more ground it has in it, the higher the compression strength. So, it's a science. I mean, it's a whole structural science in how Portland cement works and how everything comes together and how it solidifies, strengthens. It's pretty cool.
It also never ceases to amaze me. A little bit of times I've done some work. I took the last time I did anything with that, it was the fast setting concrete that you use setting posts. my lamppost on one side of the driveway was, the length of the post was cracked, so I've devised a method of holding it up straight by driving some rods in the ground and building a little platform, square platform to hold it. And mix that stuff up in a wheelbarrow, you see all that rock in there, get a nice smooth surface when you're finished.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I had to use a bag of that on Saturday because I still haven't decided where we're going to be replacing the mailbox post because I had to move the whiskey barrel that the mailbox post was associated with because the post was in first and then we dropped, made a hole in the bottom of the whiskey barrel, dropped the barrel over it, and then filled the barrel with dirt and flowers and all sorts of other things. So when they moved it and they removed the post, I lost where the mailbox was. So I have the mailbox post sitting in a 5-gallon bucket full of concrete so that I could physically place it wherever I need it to be right now.
Okay, this way you still have a mailbox.
Yeah.
You'd be amazed at the way I got this thing done. I dug down about 4 or 5 inches, about a foot square around the post, drove some rods into the ground at angles, made sure those rods did not go all the way down, the heads were up, so they'd be captured in the concrete. Built a little form, poured my concrete in. I had my lamppost set up on guys so that it wouldn't move. I had it leveled out. Poured the concrete in, troweled it over, let it set. In about an hour or so, knocked my forms out.
That's pretty much so how it's done.
And since I had the border of the driveway right next to it, I only needed a 3-sided form.
That's amazing. And she'll be in Mobile, by the way.
And she's ZEP Mobile. Just passing 168, and we're starting to slow down a little bit.
Exiting the 4-laner for the 3-laner.
Since I slowed down a little bit at 168th Street, you now know that from the 4-laner to here was flying.
Okay. I'll keep that under advisement.
So have you still been using the Jackie Robinson?
Yes, although coming home Saturday morning, because I did a double, I couldn't use the Jackie Robinson coming home because they have it shut down at 11 p.m. weeknights. So I did take the Kosciuszko into the LIE, blah, blah, blah. And it, you know, 2:30 in the morning, it wasn't bad. It was moving fine. And I got home in the correct amount of time for that hour of the morning.
Okay. Was the computer room as cold as you expected it to be?
Yeah, it had air conditioning, but at least it wasn't as noisy with all the fans and all the other, you know, things running. At least it wasn't that noisy, so I could listen to my music. But I couldn't turn off enough lights in it so that I could peek out the windows. It's in the middle of a residential neighborhood, and the buildings are quite close.
Why couldn't you turn out lights to peek out the windows? It was too bright inside, so you couldn't see out them? Why would that make a difference? Reflecting back on you?
Yes, they were like mirrored windows, and because it was dark outside and it was
bright inside. You, even if you got like right up to the glass, you still had too much extra light all around you to get a nice view of what was going on out in the world.